The Guardian.
There's something rather remarkable about finding something written 1,000 years ago that reflects how you feel today, because it makes you realize that people have had these problems forever. There is this sense of being understood, there is this sense of complicity, this sense of a problem shared. And also, I'm not mad. Other people have felt like this and expressed it rather more elegantly than I can, and that's a tremendous relief.
Hello, I'm Sian Kane, and this is the Guardian Books podcast. This week we talked to William Sieghart and Viv Groskop about the restorative properties of literature and poetry. Can books make you happier? I wouldn't argue with that at all. Yes, they can. End of. Claire, what books make you happy?
Well, do you know, the funny thing is, I read so many new books that sometimes make me very unhappy because I feel constantly overloaded. What really makes me happy is familiar books. Mm. And I am going on holiday for 2 weeks next week and I'm taking Northern Lights. And I'm going to reread Northern Lights and I am so looking forward to it. It makes me sort of shiver with pleasure, the idea of rereading Northern Lights after all these years.
I'm looking forward to that for you. That's such a great idea. I mean, I'm always a firm believer in rereading books. Like, I know people sort of have that idea that there's too many books in the world already and you can't go back and reread, but I'm absolutely the same. Like, if I need a little pick-me-up, I sometimes and go and get one of the sort of old battered hard-boiled crime novels off my bookshelf that I've read a million times. It's usually a Raymond Chandler, and I just bash through it because it's really simple. Once it's done, it's done, you know. It's not really hard ideas, it's just a simple sort of adventure, sort of schlocky drama. And I love it.
So it's Philip Pullman and Raymond Chandler for us.
Yeah. In terms of poetry, though, I can't really imagine poetry making me very happy, I'm afraid, because I just find it very intimidating.
I think a lot of people do. I think it's got a bit of an image problem. And some poetry is very difficult, but you can feel it touching your brain. It's a funny thing to say, in a way, there's an intensity about it. It's almost like it can stroke your neural pathways when it really works. I find that I can have a really, really intense reaction to a poem in the way that often you don't get from a novel or from any other sort of writing.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose this is what William's doing, trying to diagnose poems to address people's problems and sort of get them used to the idea of referring to poetry books in times of need. He's such a great boon, I suppose, to poetry in general. I mean, we've got the Ford Prize last week. It's in its 26th year, and it was set up by William. And that's done such wonders, I suppose, for introducing both new poets to the world, but also celebrating people who are very established in their careers. You went last week. What was it like? What happened this year?
Well, it's an amazing occasion, that and the T.S. Eliot Prize, in that it fills the Royal Festival Hall. I'm not completely filled, but there were 600 people there, all listening to 15 poets reading poems. Very, very pure occasion. And in some cases, as in the case of Ian Paterson, who's won the single poem prize. It's three prizes. There's single poem, first collection, and main collection. And the single poem prize was won by Ian Paterson for an elegy to his wife, Jenny Diskey, which on the page we were struggling with earlier in the day. It's very, very hard stuff. But you hear him reading and it's, you know, what I was talking about, stroking your neural pathways, it gets a very, very intense, almost like, you know, you feel the colour of your brain changing.
Yeah, that's so interesting because the four of us on their desk read that poem just to sort of see if we could sort of all nut it out a bit, and we never really came to any firm conclusions about. We just knew it was sort of in memoriam to Jenny Diskey, who was a novelist and a writer for the LRB for many years. Yeah, it's so interesting that then to have him read it himself to a crowd gives you a sort of new understanding of the exact same words.
Yeah, I mean, he's a poet who I'd say is sort of, somebody pointed out wryly to me, perhaps overly influenced by Prynne, you know, so the sort of more complicated end, formal end of poetry. But what you read on the page as a sort of formal exercise, and the verbs don't necessarily lead anywhere, and the images, you know, they sort of change all the time in a way that is quite hard to follow. When you hear him reading it with real emotion, then you know, suddenly you connect with it, but you have to let it wash over you. And I think that is one of the things that is hard for readers now, is we're so used to being actively engaged and to wanting to be able to analyse and understand, that the thing about just sitting back and letting something wash over you and not thinking of that as a passive experience, it's a positive engagement, is actually quite hard.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, and there's Sinead Morrissey as well, who won the main collection prize for On Balance. And let's hear Sinead reading from her winning collection now.
My great auntie Winnie had the dubious privilege of being a cleaner at Nottingham's Odeon Cinema. And she cleaned it the day after the Beatles played for the very first time. This is a true story. Perfume. My great auntie Winnie may as well have spotted a crack in the floor of Nottingham's Odeon Cinema, beginning under the stage like a telltale hairline fissure in a dam face, then zigzagging towards the exit, as have been struck by the actual bellwether that assailed her the morning she trudged in to sweep and mop and dust the flip-back seats after the pop music concert the night before. Not just the common enough stench of smoke and sweat, but an extra, still warm, acrid musk, the mixed-in fug of a stable in summer heat, hitting her like the reek of a hospital laundry. Because in answer to Love Me Do, offered up in spectacular harmony, 214-year-old girls had instantly wet themselves, screaming, yes, we love you already, but inaudibly, each lone voice hopeless against the squealing sheet metal square of noise. And so their bodies had taken over. Take this river, each shower a gift, intimate and articulate, to whichever identicate member they'd pinned their collapsing stomachs on. Each stream of steaming yellow, a flower. And as the crack grew ever wider and plaster flakes abandoned the ceiling and covered my auntie's rollered hair, she suddenly saw the street outside divide the length of the fissure, then the city, the north, the south, then all of England, mothers on one side, daughters on the other, and the chasm between them strung with brilliant washing. Socks and vests and stockings and skirts and pants rinsed clean with a blue bag in the kitchen sink, lifting in the wind.
Oh, I'll tell you a story about that poem.
Oh, yeah.
I didn't know what a blue bag was. And I happened to be sitting on the edge of the hall next to an usher, an elderly usher at the Royal Festival Hall. And so I turned to her and I said, what's a blue bag? And she said, don't you know it's what makes your washing whiter? And she said, I still use them. You get them down the pound shop, these. And it's a blue tablet which bleaches whiter, and you get it in a blue bag.
Oh, God, I didn't even know there was a name for that.
A blue bag. So there you go. And that's also, you know, the wonderful thing about being in a public place with poetry is that some of it is incomprehensible. And then there's somebody next door to you who has a different relationship. In this case, this usher, to whom I am very grateful. If you're listening to this, thank you.
And there's also Ocean Vuong, who has won the Best First Collection Prize for Night Sky with Exit Wounds. And Claire, you're very excited about Ocean, aren't you?
Yeah, I am. I think this is a real star. He was born in Vietnam, came over to the US when he was 2 years old. It is an amazing mix of very, very personal, very, very political, and Homer.
Yeah, yeah.
And what is interesting about these three sections of prizes is that the main prize, most of the writers are sort of fairly mainstream. They're white Irish. Actually, three of them of the five were Irish.
Wow.
But as you go down, so you get to the first collection, and there are an awful lot of BAME writers in it, and also in the single poems.
So
I think that about sort of 6 or 7 years ago, there was a sense, oh, it's Muggins' turn, that, you know, that the prize just came round and round. It's going round the same people. And now the poetry generations are really changing and different sorts of people are coming into it. And, you know, there's so much debate going on about diversity. Poetry is actually often in the vanguard of things, which I think is another reason why people think it's hard, because it's often does things before other forms of literature do it. And here is an example of it. 4 out of 5 of the single poems were from people of black and ethnic minorities, and 3 out of 5 of the first collections. So what I think you've got here is poetry is actually enacting this cultural change that the rest of us are all saying needs to happen. And here it is on the stage of the Royal Festival Hall.
So do you think the winners were obvious then, looking at the shortlist? Because they were all very strong. But
yeah, it was a really interesting thing that happened. Again, there's the sort of weird drama of being in a public place, that in all three categories, the poets read in alphabetical order, but in all three categories, the winner was the last one in the alphabet. So I was sitting there thinking, because I knew in advance, yeah. I was thinking, hang on a minute, they're just giving the game away. They're just sitting, the winning poet is at the end of the line in each occasion. But then I realised actually it was completely accidental. More seriously, Andrew Marr, who chaired it, did make a reference to vigorous and occasionally cantankerous debate. So I think it probably was properly contested. I do think that there's some really strong work. And another interesting thing is watching them perform their own work. And there's a huge difference in the level of performance. A couple of years ago, I don't know whether you remember, that they tried to get actors to read the poems.
Oh, yes, I do remember that.
Uproar in Poetry Towers. And they sort of beat a hasty retreat over that. But, you know, some poets are much better at reading than others. And I have to say that Sinead, as you heard, is great. And Ocean, fantastic, tiny little figure, totally immersed in the poet, but so charismatic.
Well, we'll be hearing more from the Forward Prize founder, William Seacart, in a minute. And you can find out more about all the winners and the runners-up at www.forwardartsfoundation.org. You're listening to the Guardian Books podcast. As we've already said, one of the difficulties of poetry is that it can be, well, difficult. Likewise, the great classics of literary fiction can seem hard going. But can poetry help you beat the blues? Can the famously gloomy novels, plays, and poetry of Russia help you sort your life out? Joining Claire to discuss these propositions were the aforementioned William Seacart of the Forward Prize and now author of a handy little tome called The Poetry Pharmacy, Tried and True Prescriptions for the Heart, Mind, and Soul. And Viv Groskop, a comedian and broadcaster whose second book proposes the Anna Karenina Fix, Life Lessons from Russian Literature. Claire began by asking William to explain his project and its genesis when he was just 8 years old.
I was really unhappy. I was a lonely little boy sent to boarding school with no friends, and about the only thing that I seemed to be able to do that the school approved of was read poetry aloud. And in that sense, I suppose that was the beginning of my relationship with poetry and how it became my friend.
And you've been doing one-to-one consultations for quite a while. This book has grown out of a life project, hasn't it?
Well, it has, actually. It grew out of, in a way, a gimmick, and unexpectedly. I produced an anthology 5 years ago, or edited one for Faber and Faber. And, you know, as we all know, once you have a book, you go on a circuit and you end up in literary festivals and things talking about it. And a friend of mine said to me, "You're always prescribing me poems to cheer me up or affect my mood or deal with grief and so on. I'm programming the Port Elliot Festival and I want you to come down and I'm going to have you interviewed by Rosie Boycott. And then afterwards, I'm setting up in a tent with 2 chairs and a prescription pad and you can listen to people's worries and prescribe them a poem." And I thought, OK, fine. These things you have to do. I'll do it for an hour in 10-minute slots. And 6 hours later, I was still in that tent with a very full bladder and started to realise that my wonderful friend Jenny Dyson's idea, she was really onto something. And having spent most of my adult life trying to get people interested in the idea of contemporary poetry and finding access points to poetry, I realised that this actually was the answer.
And the book is structured in 5 sections, and there are 56 poems which address subsections of mental and emotional well-being, for example, motivation, self-image and self-acceptance.
Yes, yeah, I suppose I conceived it as a bit like a Victorian herbalist or something like that, whereby you would look in the index and look up your mood and then see if the poem and the prescription might help you. So that there are poems for anxiety, addiction, sleeplessness, glumness, every kind of thing from grief to love. And as we know with love itself, love's got lots of stages. So there's poems from infatuation to "Help Me to Forget You, Please."
You've got, I think, 3 poems by the Sufi poet Rumi, which, he's the best represented of everyone.
Well, he and Hafez, Yes, they both get three each. I thought that was the maximum I could give. If you were brought up in Persia or modern day Iran, you know, you would have all of this would be Hafez probably. Hafez has got remarkable wisdom, and the remarkable thing about Hafez, well, the one particularly the ones I've chosen, is how what he has to say is as fresh today as it was 800 years ago when he was writing in Shiraz.
And then you go, I mean, you have some quite unusual cheer-up people like Keats, who never struck me as a very cheery sort of bloke.
No, but A Thing of Beauty is a Joy Forever is something really to think about, isn't it? And actually, I like to feel that for most people, unless they're very knowledgeable about poetry, there will only be three or four poems in this book that they will have come across before. Keats, Kipling's If, and John Donne's No Man is an Island. And one or two others, if they've either been to Liverpool Football Club or watched Carousel, they'd find You'll Never Walk Alone, the words of Oscar Hammerstein. But a lot of these poetic examples are quite obscure and people won't have come across them before.
With my sort of cynical hat on, I was thinking, oh, I wonder whether he's used a lot of very old poets because of the problems with permissions, with copyright. But you actually do have a lot of more recent poems. Poets like Imtiaz Darker, for example.
Yes, and I wanted to, my whole approach in a way was to try and find the absolutely acutely appropriate poem for the problem, irrelevant when it was written. It could be written last year or 1,000 years ago. In some ways, there's something rather remarkable about finding something written 1,000 years ago that reflects how you feel today, because it makes you realise that people have had these problems forever. And what's so striking about doing this pharmacy, and why I ended up in a tent for 6 hours, and I've been doing it ever since, to listening to hundreds of people, is that if I prescribe appropriately, if I find the right poem for the mood, people get out of the chair a foot taller. And they do, because there is this sense of being understood. There is this sense of complicity, this sense of a problem shared. And also, I'm not mad. Other people have felt like this and expressed it rather more elegantly than I can, and that's a tremendous relief.
Do you have any particular examples of feedback that shows that this has had an impact on people?
I had one extraordinary one, actually, which was I was doing a pharmacy with the mental health unit in Liverpool, and one of the people who came to see me was suffering desperately from loneliness. And it's intriguing to me in this whole subject area that loneliness is the one that seems to come out the most, and particularly exacerbated by social media, because social media actually isn't that real. People seem to put an avatar off of themselves rather than their real selves. They don't go onto Instagram and say, look at me, I'm miserable, or I'm lonely, or I want friends, or whatever. And so everybody else's wonderful parties, friends, likes, loves, and everything else makes them feel even more inadequate. And she was talking to me about this. And so I gave her two lines by Hafez, who you've just mentioned, written 800 years ago, which I've always found very powerful. And they simply go like this. I wish I could show you, when you're lonely or in darkness, the astonishing light of your own being. And I gave her a printout of that, and I told her to stick it on her mirror. And she sent me an email a few weeks later saying, you won't remember me, but, you know, you saw me in Liverpool, and last night I came home and my flat had been burgled. And in that horrible way that happens when your home has been ransacked like that, everything was in a muddle and a mess. And she said the only thing that hadn't moved were those two lines of poetry that I'd stuck on the mirror, as you told me. Thank you, she said. It got me through the night.
Ah, so that's amazing, isn't it? Now I'm going to park this here. I can see you're almost tearing up at the memory of it, aren't you? It makes me feel quite emotional as well. One tends to forget, particularly with the sort of reading that we do, that actually poetry is an emotional thing. It's important for its emotion.
Very much so, and I do think that, you know, in my lifetime dealing with people with poetry, people tend to turn to poetry in time of need. It's something we feel very strongly about, that almost prayer-like, that there's somewhere at something and in the canon somewhere that is going to help us through our most difficult times.
Now I'm going to turn to Viv. Thank you for waiting so patiently, Viv.
No, I enjoyed listening to that so much, William. What a privilege. And I just feel so moved. I loved what you said about your time as a child and how that's how you came to poetry. And I was just thinking about the little boy, William, and thinking, I will be your friend.
Thank you.
I will be your friend who likes literature and poetry.
Yeah.
Now, we know of you as a broadcaster, as a stand-up, as all sorts of things. But what I hadn't realised was you have a first-class degree in Russian and French. And
yes.
You are a pretty fluent Russian speaker, or at least Russian reader.
Yes, I speak Russian fluently.
So,
вы хотите, чтобы я доказала, что ли? Do you want me to prove it?
You could be saying anything. I'm very interested in what your project is, because as I said at the beginning, they are pretty gloomy, the Russians, as far as we take them.
Yes, well, there's a really interesting synergy with William's story, actually. And I love this proposal of bibliotherapy, which is really what you're proposing, isn't it? And this has become a whole genre now. I think it's a few years ago, it wasn't something that people really recognise. But books about reading, books that celebrate the art of reading and the love of being a reader have become something quite commonplace now. And that's how I managed to get this book off the ground finally, because it's something I'd wanted to write really for the last 20 years since I first started studying Russian when I was 18. And I came to this in a way similarly to William, like through a sort of personal crisis, in that when I was a child I had this very strange name, Groskop, that I had been saddled with, and no one could tell me where it was from. And I was always told as a child, don't ask so many questions, it's a very normal name, Groskop. It's a very British English name. Everything is fine. And when I was a teenager, I came across Anna Karenina and thought, well, that's an interesting, strange name, and started to read this book and found many, many more strange names and felt this sort of curious affinity with them. And that grew into an obsession with Russian that made me want to study at university. And then I went and lived in Russia. And I, not exactly consciously, but subconsciously, became convinced that I was Russian. And so these books became part of a quest for identity for me. And that was the comfort that I found in them. And also because the more you know of a country's literature, the better you can identify with people from that country and find a common language, even when you don't speak the language itself very well. If you can mention certain authors or certain things that you understand, then you can get on with people better. So it was a sort of shorthand for getting on with Russians as well.
So let's just start with, since we've started with poetry, let's continue with poetry and Anna Akhmatova, whose Requiem you cite. And
yes.
You in the chapter, you have these sort of quite cute chapter headings, and it's how to be optimistic in the face of despair, brackets, or don't wear tight shoes on prison visits.
Yes. So in the book, there are 11 different chapters and I cover 10 authors. And Anna Akhmatova was a poet I came across. Again, there's a synergy with William here. I came across Anna Akhmatova when I was living in St. Petersburg because there was a whole cult of people who loved to memorise her poetry and recite it aloud at these very dramatic events where people would start weeping and quailing and sort of rending their garments. And the thing about Akhmatova as well is that she's a bit like Jane Austen or Virginia Woolf, in that if you're a woman, you must like her. It's the sort of shorthand of, you know, oh, Anna Akhmatova, she will be the person for you because she's a woman. So I was slightly put off her from the beginning because I thought, I don't want to just like her work because she's a woman. But I started to discover her through these recitals that I went to, and I wanted to learn how to do it myself as well. So I did learn these crazy Russian poems and tried to recite them, you know, «Вохна столове бьется мелкий метельный снег», «И сама я не стала новой, а ко мне пришел человек». This crazy, you have to do it in a much more dramatic way than that. And you have to wear all black. And what I wanted to do with this chapter was to show the power of her work. And I wanted to show that despite Akhmatova's terrible life, I mean, her life was the most unimaginably terrible thing you could think of, that she had this quite glittering career in the 1910s when she was an aristocratic poet and she was part of the scene in St. Petersburg and in Paris. And then when the revolution comes, she has to choose, do I leave or do I stay? And it would have been so easy for her to leave and she would have been, you know, Russia's Virginia Woolf living in Paris, but she decided to stay. And eventually she was targeted by Stalin and they couldn't really do anything to her personally because she had too much profile abroad, but they arrested pretty much everyone that she knew. They sent two of her husbands, one of them was sent to the Gulag, the other one was executed. Her son was sent to the Gulag. And she was left in penury. She was not allowed to work. She was expelled from the writers' union. And everything she wrote secretly. And she wrote it from memory. She didn't even write it down. She recited it. She would write it down on a piece of paper. So the the censors who were listening in her flat couldn't hear what was being said. She'd write it on a piece of paper. The other person would memorize it, and then they would burn the paper. It's extraordinary. So Requiem is about the women who waited for news in the queues outside the prisons to find out if their relatives were alive or dead, or to hand over parcels to give to them. And a woman says to her in this queue, "Do you think you can describe this?" And she takes the challenge, which is to write this poem, Requiem. So it was written or memorized in the 1930s and not published until the 1960s, and even then only abroad. But the quote that you mentioned is when she has this moment where she has a parcel for her son and she's able to give it to him, but it means that she has to cross this courtyard wearing these really, really tight shoes that she has been standing in for hours. And that's what she's brilliant at. And perhaps that is the woman thing coming in. Perhaps a man wouldn't have picked up on that detail. I don't know. But there is something very, very human about her writing.
William, do Russian poets feature for you?
They do, but not in this book. I've featured Anna's poetry in a previous anthology. To me, the key to poetry from another language is the quality of the translation. And through the years, because I'm rather obsessed with Rumi and Hafez, I kept trying to go on, what is it that people think so great about Rumi? And then one day I read a brilliant translation and then I couldn't put it down. So that's the challenge, I think. Unless the translator is brilliant, you're a bit scuppered.
Mm. Translation, Viv. You spend quite a lot of time worrying away at not just translation of words, but translation of concepts. And the Russian obsession with fate, for example.
Yes, well, one of the things I wanted to tackle in this book was the idea that people are very intimidated by translation itself. As you mentioned, you're always thinking, well, what if this is just a bad translation? You know, what if the translator's rubbish and I'm not understanding this because of them? And then you're also thinking, well, even if it is a good translation, what if I just can't understand what the Russians mean by fate and the soul, which are huge concepts that are coming up all the time in Russian literature. And Virginia Woolf tackles this in an essay that she wrote, which talks about her love for Chekhov. And she talks about translation as being a moment where you're trying to understand people who have just stepped off a train crash and they're stumbling around and they're trying to say things to you. And you feel as if you should understand what they're saying, but you don't quite understand. And she thinks that Chekhov is the only person who breaks through that because he's on such a higher plane and he's able to describe ordinary things in such an extraordinary way. So I really wanted to get across this idea that we mustn't become too hung up on whether it's the right translation or whether we're going to exactly understand the concepts. It's just try and get over all of that and just immerse yourself and find who you really love and who the writer is who connects with you.
Mm. You have Chekhov in here with the three sisters. I wouldn't have thought of taking life advice from Chekhov's three sisters because they're so bored and they can't do anything about it. And that's part of what his world, his theatrical world,
oh,
is
well,
about.
I think if you have to take life advice from Chekhov, he is the most intelligent person ever because he was a practicing doctor for the whole of his career. Only towards the end, he stopped practicing medicine except for on himself because he was so ill with tuberculosis. So he has this incredible understanding of the human condition because he worked so hard as a writer, but at the same time, he worked just as hard as a doctor. And I love the way he portrays the hopelessness of the human condition, but always with this very strange ray of light that's sort of tinted grey, really. I always think everything in Chekhov is the colour of dishwater, but in a good way. And in Three Sisters, what I love is he does portray the despair of, oh, we must go to Moscow, Moscow, Moscow. And then they never, ever get to go to Moscow. In the final act of the play, they just stop mentioning Moscow because they realise they're just never going to go there. And all Moscow represents in that play is the idea of all of us thinking there must be something better than this. Come on. And that person over there, well, they look like they're having a nice time. Well, they're not, because they're just in the same place where they are. They're looking at you thinking you're having a better time. But what's clever about Chekhov is that he portrays the despair, but he always undercuts it with humour. So for me, that's the lesson that I take from him, is that, yes, you get that identification that you were mentioning, William, of the loneliness thing of knowing someone else has been through what you're going through. But he offers a solution, which is you have to accept it and laugh at it.
Isn't part of what's going on? It's not about a poem or a play or a novel that counteracts your misery, but one that actually chimes with your misery.
Exactly. Because a poem isn't just going to suddenly get you out of grief or get you out of a broken heart, any of those kinds of things, but it helps you to feel understood. And that is the most reassuring feeling of the lot. And as I go back to where we began about loneliness, a lot of people don't have anyone to talk to. And so the poem becomes that friend.
Mm. And Vivian, I want to just talk a little bit about your chapter on Dr. Zhivago, which we think of now as quite a cheesy novel. But this is a classic example of the hero being not very admirable in a lot of ways.
Yes, I mean, Zhivago is a much maligned novel. It's become very unfashionable. And it was partly Nabokov who led the charge on that. He was constantly saying that he was the one who should have won the Nobel Prize. And Zhivago is no novel and Pasternak is no kind of writer. And it's become, as you say, something of a cheesy novel, and especially because I love the film with Omar Sharif
and Julie Christie.
I love that. So I wanted to slightly reinstate the importance of Zhivago, but again, it's quite a depressing book, and Zhivago's fate is so hilariously miserable. You know, he goes through all of these terrible trials and tribulations and cheats on his wife and then can't be with his mistress and is persecuted by the authorities for his poetry, which is all at the back of the novel. And in the end, he just dies this very lonely and hopeless death, and nothing has really been achieved. But again, it's shot through with beauty and light. It has this motif of the colour mauve in it, which is Pasternak's favourite colour. Weirdly, it's also Nabokov's favourite colour. It was one of the only things that the two of them had in common. They couldn't stand each other. But I sort of rediscovered Zhivago, actually, because I wanted to reinstate it. And I had to do that in my own mind as well. And I think it's actually beautifully written, and it's really stood the test of time, I think more so than people have given it credit for.
In your explanation of why these books matter and why they're important, you go into your own life. They're little episodes. And in this one, there's this particularly striking episode of the death of a young person that you knew when you were there.
Yes. So for me, Zhivago is about death, and it starts with a funeral. And when I think of it now, it reminds me of this funeral I happened to go to in Russia. And it was just this extraordinary, terrible coincidence that when I first arrived there, I was in my early 20s. All of my friends were in their late teens and early 20s. And it was my third or fourth visit to Russia. So I had a sort of growing group of Russian friends out there. And when I first arrived to spend my year abroad as part of my degree, I was going to be in St. Petersburg for the whole year. Within the first few weeks, a girl who I knew quite well committed suicide, and obviously this was horrible for everyone, and I felt very strange about it because she wasn't one of my close friends from home, but she was someone I'd started to get to know, and she was very much a part of this friendship group that I'd attached myself to. And so I then had this very awkward, tragicomic experience of not knowing whether it was okay to attend her funeral, but everybody wanting me to go. And it just had all of these terrible moments in it where we went to this morgue in the middle of nowhere, and I had never seen a corpse before, and suddenly I walked into this warehouse full of corpses. And I had been asked on the way there, I eventually discovered really why people wanted me to be there. And I was asked if I would bring my makeup with me, my Western makeup. This was in the early 1990s when no one had anything. And I just didn't think anything of it and just brought it without asking. And they wanted it so that they could make her up.
Mm. Make up her face. And that is such an illuminating anecdote in a way. You just think that there is so much. You know, I think of the Russian literature I've read, and it's full of such extreme incidents.
Yes, that was a Clinique compact I never used again.
I think also what intrigues me is when you delve into the 19th century Russian novel or French novel or English novel, or when you delve even further back through literature, how often and how striking it is that you're hit with a clarion call of something about the present, and you somehow are stunned that people thought the same way all those years ago. And because you like Hafez, I found a good example of this. So Hafez wrote in Persia, Islamic Renaissance, 800 years ago, in a Muslim country. And this is a poem called It Happens All the Time in Heaven. It happens all the time in heaven, and someday it will begin to happen again on earth, that men and women who are married, and men who are lovers, and women who give each other light, often will get down on their knees, and while so tenderly holding their lover's hand with tears in their eyes, will sincerely speak, saying, "My dear, how can I be more loving to you? How can I be more kind?"
You rest your case. Now, just to finish off, absolutely fascinating. I'm going to have to be prescribing this book, I think, to all my friends for Christmas, which presumably is partly the point of them. We did actually put this out on the Guardian Books Twitter stream to find out if anybody had any problems they'd like to be solved. And we had two responses, which I'm going to put to both of you, although it was originally addressed to William. Somebody called Audi Can't Fail said, "I'm on a quest to feel moved, numb from the world around me. I feel like I'm missing the catharsis of tears. What's the poetry remedy for this?"
Well, I wonder whether you really want to cry, whether that really is the answer. Actually, a lot of depressed people say to me, "I need to be brought out of my depth of my depression." And there's a most remarkable poem called Everyone Sang by Siegfried Sassoon, not a man known for his poems that cheer you up, as you might say, but it's about an explosion of song. And that I find emotionally transformational. If you want to cry, read Philip Larkin's Obeyed, A-U-B-A-D-E, which is all about lying awake and being frightened of dying, which we all do at some stage or other in our lives.
Viv?
I would prescribe Chekhov's short stories because they are like poems in that I think when you're feeling really sad and you really want to cry, you don't have a big concentration span. And that's why poetry is perfect, because you can just read something very quickly. And Chekhov's short stories are like that. So I would prescribe any of them, but especially one called A Boring Story, and also Lady with Lapdog.
And the other question, which I'm going to paraphrase because it's slightly long, it's from somebody called I Have Done, and he is a student who's been doing work, been on work placement, and has been struggling to keep up with university work, working till 1 o'clock, and is about to go into his her third year. How does he/she get refresh himself or herself?
Blimey, vodka, I think. Or alternatively, Pro Plus is probably what I was using when I was trying to learn Russian verbs at 5:30 in the morning, cramming. To refresh you and wake you up, I would prescribe definitely not the Russians, I think.
William?
I think Derek Mahn's Everything Is Going to Be All Right might be rather consoling at this stage.
We all need a little bit of that.
We do.
Thank you very much for coming in.
Well, that's all we have time for this week. Many thanks to William and Viv. The Anna Karenina Fix by Viv Groskop is published by Fig Tree, and The Poetry Pharmacy by William Seacart is by Alan Lane.
Next week, we'll be talking to novelists Orhan Pamuk and Nicole Krauss. In the meantime, you can join in the discussion on Twitter at Guardian Books or on the Guardian website. Just search for Guardian Books Podcast, which is also how you'll find us in your favourite podcast app.
But for now, from me, Sian Kane.
And me, Claire Armistead.
And our producer, Simon Barnard. Thank you for listening. Goodbye.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.